watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We've been running a series, Onondaga Land Rights and Our Common Future, a cooperative education project between the Onondagas and their non-Indian neighbors in Syracuse, which has been bringing Haudenosaunee speakers into dialogue with the people of Central New York, not only about the specific issue of land claims and treaty rights, but also the culture and history of the original people of this place. This is, of course, of great interest to Onondagas and Haudenosaunee generally, the Six Nation Confederacy to which the Onondagas belong, and to the people of Central New York living in the land area in question. But this dialogue also has a much wider significance, not only to indigenous peoples all over the world, but to the human race that is facing a question of survival in a devastated environment and is dominated by a prevailing culture whose values and systems have not only caused the problems, but are under the control of people who care more about perpetuating their personal privileges than the general well-being. The traditional culture of the Haudenosaunee with its ancient values of equality and tolerance, respect for one another and nature, and regard for future generations, I believe, provides us with a social model that can help us not only survive as a species, but also be happy. In the next 2 hours, we'll turn our history inside out, beginning with Professor John Mohawk of the Seneca Nation.
Welcome to our educational series, Onondaga Land Rights and Our Common Future. It is my pleasure, on behalf of our Native student organization at SU, to introduce our speaker tonight. So it is with great honor and respect that I will introduce our speaker. John C. Mohawk, PhD, is a Seneca author and professor in the Center for the Americas at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He is the director of the Indigenous Studies Center. He is the founder and director of the Iroquois White Corn Project and the Pinewoods Cafe located on the Cattaraugus Territory. He served as editor for Akwesasne Notes from 1967 to 1983. In 1978, he was contributing editor to A Basic Call to Consciousness, a book about the issues taken to a conference in Geneva, Switzerland, in an effort to establish international law standards for rights for indigenous peoples. The work of Akwesasne Notes during the years 1976 to 1983 was of significant importance to the movement of Native people seeking human and civil rights. In 1987 to 1995, Mohawk served as editor for Daybreak, a national magazine which focused on Native American and Indigenous topics. He is author of dozens of newspaper and magazine articles and received the Native American Journalism Association Best Historical Perspective of Indigenous People Award in 2000 and 2001. He co-edited Exiled in the Land of the Free, Democracy, Indian Nations, and the U.S. Constitution with Orrin Lines. His latest book is Utopian Legacies, A History of Conquest and Oppression in the Western World, A History of the Impact of Revitalization Movements on the History and Culture of Western Civilization. He teaches a wide range of courses, including topics in cultural history, American Indian history, Native American identity crisis, American Indian law, American pluralism, and others. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest speaker, Dr. John C. Mohawk. Welcome.
I'd like to begin this by having an explanation a little bit about what the Americas were in 1491 and before that. Just a few thoughts about that. And that I think it's important for people to sort of grasp this idea, which is that for a very long time, specific Indian peoples occupied areas of North America, and that when they occupied these areas as nations. And when they occupied them, there was no question about whose law was on that land or whose customs were there. For all that time, Indian nations interacted with one another, and Indian nations built up their own versions of culture. And they pretty much made their own laws and had their own way of doing things. So you can say that of the long history of North America since probably the Ice Ages, that independent, distinct nations of Indian people existed in North America, among which, of course, are the ones locally. And so there's no question that they were sovereign nations, that they had the right, and in fact did, make war and peace, and that they lived this way for a really long time. So it wasn't as if there was anything new going on in the area of sovereignty or jurisdiction or any of those things that we think of today when it comes to what it is to be a nation. And in the beginning, the earliest European contacts with Indian nations, the European nations treated with the Indian nations as nations. There was no conversation in the 1610s, 20s, 30s, 40s about whether or not they were dealing with nations. The protocols were nation to nation. The rhetoric was nation to nation. The Indian nations fit perfectly the European version of what a nation is. And so there was a nation-to-nation relationship, was the very first relationships between native North American nations and European nations. That said, we have to say also that they were very different kinds of cultures. And in our modern rendition of things, they set into motion a large conversation about things. And so just for a moment, let me take us back just in very broad outlines, huge outline of where things came from on the European side to just kind of get a handle on why things were the way they were there, and then we'll come over to the native side. I would tell you that a version of a modern European nation, or at least its roots, happened at the time of Charles Martel when the Muslim armies invaded Europe, and they moved as far as France, and then they were repelled. The Muslims of the time were horsemen, and their attacks on European armies and militaries had been quite successful. And it was interesting that the Europeans in the 8th century were anxious to find ways to defend themselves. At that first one, the first invasion, the Muslim armies turned back after a not very vigorous effort, but there was a worry that they would return. So there was a reorganization on a substantial level in Europe of how things were done. And the reorganization went around two things. It had to do with a new relationship between property and military. The Europeans determined that in order to be able to repel or fight effectively against the Muslims, they were going to have mounted warriors who would develop into knights. To have those, they were going to have military people who had access to horses trained for battle, and these people were going to have to train for battle themselves. So there arises in Europe a culture in which there's a relationship between land ownership and your responsibilities to be able to present yourself on the battlefield with a horse and eventually with armor. Now, normally we wouldn't be thinking about that, except that this becomes really important in the relationship between what becomes government and property, in that in the feudal system there was a requirement that those people who had land had an obligation to provide military service And they were organized in order to provide defense, and when they needed to provide offense. So in a way, you could call the medieval European system of things, including the medieval European governmental system, a very hierarchical military kind of system. So when we look at how things were in the years following the first Islamic invasions and how the traditions and customs of Europe unfold, we have to know that there was a relationship there. Okay, when we get to the Americas, we will remember at first, were an unexpected revelation. Whatever else we ought to say about the Christopher Columbus voyages, and whoever was first, and whoever did this or that, the awareness of occupied lands to the west becomes widespread when Columbus reports that he found land and he found people in 1492. And upon that discovery, there kicks into motion a series of issues and questions. And the most important of those ones were, who are these people that they have encountered? Now, the encounter, as everybody has probably come to realize by now, was not an informed encounter. Columbus thought that he had reached Asia. And according to the way people of his day thought, it almost had to be Asia. There was no knowledge of any place between Europe and Asia. So if you found land and people, they must be Asia and Asians. In fact, that's how come the name for the Indians. But this set into motion a difficult problem, and that was that there was no piece of European knowledge that could locate and identify who the people were and who the lands were. And in fact, it was going to start a huge crisis in confidence. Europe's culture explained to itself that it had divine authorities based on the idea that they had all the information and knowledge that the supernatural had intended them to have. And to find a place that was not in the Bible was a crisis. They had to know where it was. You might not think that that was a huge thing, but in a way, it's one of the things that sets forth one of the great evolutions in European culture, which is the Protestant movement, which was to question whether they had been given the proper information, because it didn't seem as if the omission of a couple of continents was a possibility. The next thing that happened was, once they started encountering people, reports started going back to Europe of how the people that they had encountered were really quite different from Europeans. Now, this conversation accelerates a lot starting in the early parts of the 17th century. It was already happening a little bit, but it accelerates because there's really a curiosity here. People are starting to report that they're encountering societies that don't have the hierarchy and don't have the customs of any sort that were common in Europe. Europe's theory of society required that people be, you have to say, subjected to a considerable amount of coercion in order to be able to be a viable society. And then they came to North America, and people started reporting that they had encountered societies that had no apparatus of state coercion. Indeed, that had no hierarchy of government, or very little hierarchy of government as people knew it. So I'm saying that Europeans came from a place where the military requirements of their society had created an extremely hierarchical government, almost, you might say, in those fiefdoms, which were small ones, but in the microcosm of the fiefdom, you had what amounted to small military dictatorships there, and stratified society. You had a ruling group, and then you had a group that did all the work. There wasn't much in between that. There was a class of people who belonged to the priesthood or the church generally, but in any given small unit, that was small, and often non-existent on a small unit. And so the norm in the European society would have been this society where people expected a great deal of direction from some authoritative figure. Then they came to North America, and people started reporting that there were whole societies that didn't have any authoritative figures. And this set in motion a bunch of questions. In fact, there are some of the most interesting philosophical questions in European history. People questioned whether it might be possible for there to be societies in which there was no government, or if there was a government, the government didn't have the power to enforce its edicts. And if the government doesn't enforce its edicts, what is it that keeps order? In North America, the French especially sent missionaries into the Indian country who came back and reported that there were societies there that had good order, in fact, even better order than they were used to seeing in Europe, in which crimes were rare, in which internal violence was rare, and in which disputes seemed to get settled without violence, all of which was done in the absence of a coercive state or any kind of coercive organization at all. And this raised the question that started to circulate through Europe, and especially in the quarters where people were able to read and write and think about that kind of thing. It started raising the question about whether that coercion and the military dictatorship model was a necessity. So early on, even in the early 1600s, and then forward from there, there started to be a conversation which we see eventually manifested in the philosophers, asking the questions whether or not the natural condition of man required that there be a coercive governmental entity. Now, before we can get to the issue of democracy, there has to be the potential for people to make decisions. And of course, in a real autocratic state, they're not only forbidden to make such decisions, but they're punished if they take any steps in that direction. So you couldn't do it because you couldn't think about it. And you couldn't think about it because if you did, somebody would come knocking on your door, drag you off to the castle, take you down into the basement, and adjust your thinking. Okay, among the people whose voices come to us and who we think about when we think about the foundation of a European tradition, Euro-American eventually, tradition, are people like John Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, Montaigne. And of those, you want to think for a moment, I would take you just for a moment to think about somebody like John Locke. John Locke is often pointed to, and people say, well, he was one of the philosophers who inspired the American tradition of democracy. And he indeed was. Of course, having said that, a lot of people don't seem to read what it was that John Locke said, because a lot of what John Locke said, we at this point of the thing would have trouble saying, well, here's a democratic sort of fellow. A lot of what he has to say isn't very democratic. More interesting, in a way, was the conversation that happened from Rousseau, who tried to connect nature and humanity. He thought that if you got rid of all of the trappings of coercive kinds of society and all of its rationalizations, its education system, its socialization, that you'd end up with a human being in a state of nature who was a admirable being, for the most part. How did it happen that people began to be informed about what that might look like and begin to formulate ideas that actually elevated the concept of what humans were capable of? For one thing, what was happening, which is hard for us in the 20th century to grasp, was that the conversation about what was going on in the Americas, especially in Western Europe and especially in France, was very much more informed than a lot of us really are aware of. And that's because there were not only missionaries who were writing back things all the time, but there were other writers who were writing back things all the time. And the writers were writing about their experiences with Indians. Now, the Jesuits and their reporters, the Jesuits wrote 76 volumes, which came back and were published in France. France was the most literate country in Western Europe at the time. And when you read some of the French stuff, it varies. You know, if you're going to write 76 volumes, a lot of people writing it, you're going to get a lot of different things in there. But some of the things that come across are some Jesuit priests who actually have some admiration for the Indian societies that they encounter. Some of them see things in the Indian societies that they say would be unimaginable among the European society. And there are those ones who write back and say that there's quite a lot of dignity and quite a lot of order, and that Indians followed their own rules without any policemen prodding them to do so. Which actually, if you read the whole body of this, there's quite a lot of that kind of urging that goes on. In other words, Europeans, at least on one level, were being fed a description of life among the Indians as being not so terrible. Now, this is in contradiction, really, to expectations of some other writers, especially some of the British materialist writers, who thought that anybody who lived in a state of nature lived in a state in which their lives were nasty, brutish, and short. One of my friends says that was a misprint. It meant their wives. Their wives were... But they thought that what would happen if people found their way into... away from civilized society is that they would degenerate, somewhat like a much later novel on The Lord of the Flies describes adolescents being naturally drawn to conditions which were not very pleasant. As time would go by, though, there would be much more interaction and much more experience between Europeans and Indians, and those interactions are going to be reported by people. One of the ways that this happens is from the fact that almost from the time of the English colonists arriving, some of the English colonists left where they were brought to and disappeared off into the forest. And if you disappeared into the North American forest in the early 17th century, your only hope of survival is to find your way to the Indians. And many of them were young people, and many of them found their way there. And in fact, for over a century, there were many, many Europeans, young ones mostly, but some not so young, who found their way into the Indian country who hadn't been captured, who just found their way there. And then later, of course, there'd be some who were captured in war and found their way into the Indian societies. And the Europeans began to, Europeans, at this point they're Euro-Americans, they began to notice something. If a person joined an Indian group for any period of time, say they went off and lived with the Indians for a couple of years, when they were discovered next, they were often reluctant to rejoin the European group. I was taken by some of the explanations for this by moderns. People like James Axtell, who writes about this, said that he thought that maybe one of the reasons was because the Indians wore moccasins, and moccasins were more comfortable than shoes, and therefore they were more, But a much more compelling observation is made both at the time and I think by anybody of much in the way of common sense. Take the case of young women who found their way into the Indian country. Young women would generally, who were in the English colonies, who would be likely to run away, probably were in some state of indentured servitude, which is a state of supposedly temporary slavery. They were defenseless pretty much at the hands of their masters. We can't even imagine what kind of behaviors they were subjected to. And at some point or another, they show up in the Indian country. When they get into the Indian country, the Indians generally adopted them. They generally took them in and made them part of their families, gave them their names, gave them parents, gave them everything, and made them part of the tribe. And once they were in there, people found that life with the Indians was not that unpleasant. As a matter of fact, I would urge upon you that living with the Indians in this period of time was really a heck of a lot better. If you were there now and you had to choose between living in the English colony or living with the Indians, you'd have probably choose the Indians. In the English colony, they woke you up before it got light, and they made you work all day long, and they more or less let you quit after it got dark. And it was really a long period of drudgery, and that was in the slow times of the year. On the Indian side, though, in a way, the Indians were sort of living in a permanent, sort of like a vacation camp. In a way, the Indians were essentially focused on village life. They didn't make bread. They didn't do a lot of extreme drudgery, although everybody worked there. But there was less hours a day put into work. And there was hunting, and there was a lot of socializing, and just sort of generally the relaxed atmosphere of the Indian village. A lot of people who had the choice between those two checked the Indian box and said, "I'll stay here." There was the other problem, too, though. There was a great deal more human respect that came from in the Indian camp. One could make an argument that there was more, that women, for example, had more presence, more rights, if you would, than you would have had in the English camp. And so there was quite a lot of that that probably attracted people, adopted women got those rights too. But then what about the males? There are many examples in the record of males who went and joined the Indians. And there's stories, descriptions of events where somebody ran away. And 2 years later or so, there would be some kind of meeting between the group and the Indians. And somebody from the English side would look at one of the Indians and see that the Indian looked like a little bit blonde and the eyes were kind of blue. But he was dressed like an Indian. He had paint on and looked like an Indian. And when he went up to talk to him, he wouldn't speak English. He spoke whatever it was, Algonquin. And we'll try as you will, he wouldn't break the thing. But they'd look at him and says, you know, you look a little bit like Charles Wilkins who ran away from the plantation 2 years ago. And the guy wouldn't acknowledge that. And this happened over and over again. They saw them in the guise of Indians, and those people who refused to come back. So powerful was this after a while that Benjamin Franklin writes in one of his commentaries that if any Englishman escapes to the Indians, they'll never come back. So if we had a first vote and people had a choice in the first round with the Indian societies, people tended to vote with their feet and they voted to move with the Indians. And in fact, they would stay that way until life among the Indians had become extremely more difficult as a result of really vast changes. But as long as the Indian societies had integrity, people moved in there. People told stories that I just have to recount one of them for you to give an idea how powerful this kind of thing happened over a long period of time. One young man I think he was maybe 18 or 19, and he was captured in a raid into Massachusetts. And he found himself in a Mohawk village on the St. Lawrence River. And he told this story later when he repatriated himself. He said that he got to the village, and the Indians, an old woman, adopted him, chose him, because her son had died. And so he became her son. He got his name, and they adopted, big, big ceremony. And of course, the Indian rule had it that once you are adopted, they never mention where you came from before that. I mean, your previous life is over with, and now you have your new life. So he's got his new life, his new name, his new mother, his new thing. But he says the problem was that the fellow that he replaced had all his life been a liar and a lazy lout, and people didn't have any respect for him. And he said, no matter how hard I tried, nobody ever believed a word I said, and they always thought that I was a lazy no good, and I could never get past it. So when you got adopted, you really got adopted, and your identity was really switched. And people... there was plenty of these. There's a whole large numbers of people who recount that was the kind of thing that happened. One of the first Europeans who went into the Indian country to try to understand how things worked among them was one of the more, you might even say, revolutionary people from that period. He was a Puritan. His name was Roger Williams, and he did his work in New England. He was a very good scholar, very bright man, and almost from the moment he got off the boat from England, he went off into the woods and he joined Algonquin Indians and he learned their languages. He learned several Indian languages, and he went and lived with them for a while. When he came back and he rejoined the Puritans, his compatriots started worrying that he had picked up a lot of bad ideas while he was over there with the Indians, among which was the idea that people ought not to dictate to other people what they should believe in, having to do with the spiritual or the supernatural. And so he criticized Puritan society for its coercive requirements that people had to believe in a certain religion in a certain way. And he articulated to them that the Indians didn't do that. Well, I could just understand how that might have worked, especially if he was engaging Indians, and those Indians were the same as our Indians are, I think it's easy to see how that might have worked. The Indians, by and large, did not believe that you could command someone to believe something. You couldn't order them to do it. If you did order them to do it, it was an abuse of their spirit. If you made somebody accept a religion at the point of a gun, you committed a crime against them. Was the way the Indians saw it. Anyway, inside the Indian country, the Indians had long ago adopted a strategy for dealing with dissent. And if Roger Williams at first had come to them and he had said, well, you know, I have this religion I want to introduce you to, the chances were very good, as many missionaries found out, that the Indians would be very open to hearing what it was that you wanted to tell them. So you would say, well, I want you to listen to this, and told them a story they want to tell, and have the service that goes with that, teach them some hymns, blah, blah. The Indians would go right along with that. That was fine. They were okay. Then the missionaries would come back, and Roger Williams came back and informed them they were doing their old ceremonies again. So then he goes and explains to them. He says, no, you don't understand. Once you embrace this religion, you have to forsake all other religions. You can't do the stuff you were doing before. At some point, one of them had to have grabbed him and pulled him aside and said, Mr. Williams, if we do that, we'll spend all our time arguing with each other about what to believe in. He said, we don't do that. Here, everybody can believe in whatever it is they want to believe in, as long as they don't impose themselves on other people. So as long as they respect the integrity and the well-being of their neighbors, we accept that. He said, it's even deeper than that. For many of the belief systems that people have in an Indian community, they are forbidden. They are forbidden to not only to proselytize other people and go tell them you have to believe this, they're forbidden to tell other people what it is that they believe in. And if you look into a traditional Indian society, you will see that there are many distinct beliefs, that they believe in a lot of different things. But once you're inducted into that belief system, a part of your induction is that you have to keep it a secret. You can't tell anybody. That's what they call those things. If you look in the anthropology stuff in the Northeast Woodlands, they call those secret societies. But it's also a way that people had of avoiding having internal disruptions about arguing about religion. And in fact, until you had a coercive religion that came along, there wasn't much in the way of things messed up inside the Indian country. Actually, Roger Williams accepted that. He accepted that, and when he went back, he had two real major things. The first is that he believed that all people ought to have the religion of their conscience, which is the beginnings of any real freedom of religion, actually. And then the other thing that he believed is that he told the English that he didn't think that they had the right to claim or take the property on land of the Indians, which of course didn't make him terribly popular among his brethren, but he was the first one to make, at least as far as we know, a significant person, to make a strong argument that the claim of discovery wasn't an adequate claim to the property of the Indians. This would eventually become pretty widely accepted in the field of law, in fact, that discovery alone of land does not entitle you to the land if somebody's already on the land and has ownership of it. It only gave people, by the European way of thinking, it only gave the nation that discovered the land the right to negotiate to buy the land should the natives choose to sell it. It didn't give them the right to claim it as a property right. As time would go on, there would be significantly more interactions between the Indians and the non-Indians. But I think it's a very vital, important thing to understand. Up until about 1830, in the North American, especially North American Anglo world, the interaction with Indians was far more common than seems to have been the case, according to the way the story is told by later generations. The Indians were everywhere in the society, and it was just common. There was Indians in lots of towns, lots of times, and lots of interaction with the Indians. Americans were starting to be thinking about how the Indians governed themselves, and there was a conversation that went on among them because Europeans and Indians were constantly in diplomatic contact. There was constant give and go, conversations were going on left and right, and many of these spilled into everyday ordinary conversation. I would like to point out that one of the things that was happening was that people were reporting conversations, and there's going to be an argument about whether the conversations they reported were fictional or whether the conversations reported were historical. But let's put that aside. I think what you had were conversations that were, in fact, inevitable. People had these conversations, And whether or not they had them in the exact places that the historical record says they had, those conversations were being had. And the conversations were sort of like this. People were reporting that Indians had an opinion of European government and European culture. Now, by the time we get to the 1680s and 1690s, we already have Indians who have been to Europe and back. So when the Baron de Lahontan reports on a conversation with an Indian who he says has been to France, there were Indians who had been to France, and some of them had been around and seen things. In the conversations that they describe, and especially one with a person who comes down to us known as the Rat, a Huron Indian, the Indian fellow is talking with the Frenchman about who's got the better form of government. And the Frenchman is saying essentially that their form of government is ordered, organized, and ordained, if you would. And the Indian guy replies back. He said, I've been to your country, and I've seen it. And he says, there's only one free man in your country, only one who can speak his mind. And the guy doesn't really have much he could say, but he wasn't intending to say anything. He was making a point. And the point was that in the Indian world, everybody was free to speak their mind. So the idea that people could criticize the government, of course, is still a controversial one. It's right in our day, right now, it's controversial. But then it was sort of like at the beginnings of being sort of unheard of, that it was a right that you could do that. And then the Indians, it turned out, had always done that. When the first English actually encountered the Indians in New England, they were a long ways from England, and they had to come up with some form of meetings to make decisions. They noticed that the Indians met in town meetings, which is still in some parts of New England a common occurrence. So actually the British colonists started meeting in town meetings. Now one of the things about a town meeting, which is different from the way things had been in England, is that it solicits the participation, input, and opinions of all the people in the meeting. And it doesn't work if people are coerced or told to shut up or any of that kind of stuff. It doesn't work very well. The town meeting becomes an exercise, if you would, and something that approaches free speech. So it becomes a conversation about whether you can have free speech or not. And one of the things that's a reality is that it's the Indians who are held up as the model of a society that tolerates free speech. So already we have, before the middle part of the 18th century, we have conversations about the rights of people potentially to be free of coercion about their choices in religion. And we have conversations about the rights of people to be able to practice free speech, even to criticize the government. And these two conversations are happening in America, and they're happening in the context of people's contact with and interaction with the Indians. But even having ideas about how a more democratic thing would work doesn't really work unless you have mechanisms. How do you have a more democratic system of things to work? A way to do it would be town meetings, but I think we can all agree that a big town meeting is kind of limited. It's limited to how many people can be in a town. You couldn't actually have a governing body or a governing thing with some sort of democratic order that involved 100 towns or 1,000 towns or whatever. You couldn't get the meetings together. There would have to be some sort of mechanism to transmit the democratic will of the people from those towns to whatever the center was that represented the larger governmental organization. And that became a piece of a conversation that was going to be happening beginning really in the middle of the 18th century. Now, here's where things get kind of controversial, if you want to have controversy. The person, if we may say this, who probably had the most to do with inventing the idea of an independent country made up of the British colonies had to be Benjamin Franklin. He was thinking about that 20 years before other people. Actually, there were other people who thought about it too, but and even a couple before him, but he was the one who really, was at the center of things. He was the one whose voice articulated the need to do that. And he was the one who carried, you could say, most of the responsibility for writing about that, talking about that, making that a possibility. Among the things that he did, however, was that Benjamin Franklin had an abiding interest in Indians, and not just Indians as a whole, but he seemed to know a lot about and think about and talk quite a bit about Iroquois Indians. So eventually it would be Benjamin Franklin who would be asked to participate in the organization of a plan to unite the colonies. Now the plan was to unite the colonies in order to unite them against the French. But he organized the meeting, and he came up with a plan about how the colonies could be unified. It would be called the Albany Plan of Union. Among his travels and among the things that he did, he purportedly attended a Mohawk condolence ceremony. Now, we don't know what a Mohawk condolence ceremony might have been. Some condolence ceremonies are quite elaborate, and some of them carry with them long speeches that go back to the origins of the Six Nations Confederacy and explain where it came from and essentially how it worked and so on and so forth. Some are much less elaborate than that, and he didn't leave any notes, and we don't know exactly what happened. We do know he went to that, and then a little while later he shows up in Albany, and he has a plan of union. Those of you who follow the Onondaga Nation stories and see the symbols and emblems and stuff of the Onondaga Nation, I ask you to think about this. There's a wampum, a string of beads that represents the Council of the Six Nations. The wampum is in a circle, and inside the circle there's strings that represent each of the chiefs. There's a circle of beads and 50 strings representing 50 chiefs. That's the symbol of the Confederacy Council. And you can see it in books. And there's a poster. I saw it on this afternoon. And it's all over the place. The Indians memorialized their documents and their institutions and the agreements they made with other nations. And sometimes they simply memorialized people using shell beads. And the shell beads were woven into different shapes and forms, and they represented different things. But there were many, many hundreds of wampum belts that were exchanged, and the wampum belts had the power in some cases, the power of treaties, and in other cases, the memory of the nation's own institutions and its origins. The circle wampum is one of those belts. Circle of chiefs, 50 chiefs. Now you want to go back to the Albany Plan of Union. And what he proposes. And what he proposes is that there be representatives sent to a central council meeting, 50 of them. And then he goes on to talk about how to create this in the form of a confederacy, and how the confederacy would have a central location and how it would work. And in fact, the new colonies were surrounded, you have to say, by a sea of Indian confederacies. Confederation was the form of government chosen by the Indians. A confederacy means that essentially that each of the units has a certain amount of independence, but it has a unity. It's sworn to unified behaviors so that if they make a treaty, all the members of the group, the confederacy, are members who have the treaty as an obligation for their group. The Albany Plan of Union has other elements to it, but I want to point out just the one. I really want to just sort of mention this because people are going to come back and they're going to say, well, it's not possible. It wasn't true that the Albany, that the Indians influenced the thinking of how the new government was going to be formed. But it seems to me that the fact that the first draft of the first proposal to bring a unified government to the colonies looks very, very similar to the way of the Six Nations form of government, that the second form is also a confederation, and that the people who are hammering it together have had a long and fairly detailed relationship with Indians. It is argued that it's not possible that the Indians could have inspired the government, even though there's a whole bunch of statements by people at the time saying that they had a lot of respect for that, and they were impressed by it, and they thought this was pretty good stuff and so forth. Despite all of that, it's said that it couldn't possibly be. And so that's the part that I really came here tonight to talk about. Here's my question. Could it be that the Indians may have inspired. Now, look it, to inspire something, one does not get up in the morning and say, boy, I'm going to go over there and talk to so-and-so and inspire him, right? That doesn't work. In fact, you couldn't do that if you wanted to. In fact, human behavior doesn't work that way. They wouldn't do it anyway. But to inspire something simply means that somebody sees something that works and tries to adapt that which works to that which they need. So could it be that they adapted some of the elements of the American government were adapted from elements of Indian government? Could that be? Second, what about the tradition of not kowtowing to a hierarchical authority? When the American Revolution happens and Europeans arrive later, especially European nobility arrives in North America, between 1784, let's say, and about 1830, they're always impressed with how people are consciously not willing to kowtow to aristocracy. It's in the form of something like the guy with the fancy coat and everything coming in, sitting down in the parlor and saying, could you get me a cup of coffee? And the person in the parlor saying, get your own goddamn coffee. I'm giving you coffee. There was that attitude toward the aristocracy in the Americans after the Revolution. And I think that was the second piece of it. There was a culture which existed for a while that was contemptuous of the trappings of authority and did not equate wealth with the right to boss people around. That's changed, I think, but that's what it was like for a while. So how could it be that there would be such a very, very virulent argument that there couldn't have been any relationship between the democratic tradition practiced by the Indians and some of the democratic thinking and practices by the new American government, almost to the point where people are hounded who even suggest that there might be a relationship to that? There is a book by a fellow by Roland Van Zandt called The Metaphysics of American Democracy. And it's about the philosophy of history. And it goes kind of like this. You kind of got to follow me here, but because we're going to have to move through this. But it goes like this. The early American historians, which are people who didn't exist during the period of the American Revolution, the ones that come later, developed something called a consensus in American history. And the consensus in American history goes this way. It says that there was a consensus that no American historian dared to counter. And the consensus was that a generation of Americans had fought the British for freedom and liberty. And that this fight that they fought for them was such a noble fight, it was such a noble cause, that it stands forever as separating them from all the other nations of the earth. That the Americans had, by their struggle against the British, had acquired the mantle of the carriers of liberty and democracy throughout the world. And that when you are the carrier of the mantle of liberty and democracy throughout the world, you are excused from all the rules that apply to everybody else in the world. You can do anything you want to anybody, forever. In addition, it raises, I think, a very, very cute question, and it's one I'd like to have everybody go home and think about tonight as you're doing it. There has been said, it has been stated in the American modern contemporary life, they hate our freedoms. Now, that's a tricky question or a tricky issue in philosophy, because freedom isn't one of those things that floats out there all by itself. You have to finish the sentence. You have to say, our freedoms from blank. A freedom isn't a freedom unless it's a condition that exists in the absence of some previously existing condition, which is counter to the freedom, okay? So you can't have a freedom. It's impossible for it to even exist unless you had a condition that denied you freedom. But what is the condition that denied you freedom? Was it freedom from unlawful detention, from extraordinary rendition? Was it a freedom from not being able to confront your accuser? Was it a freedom from not being able to enjoy habeas corpus? What was it a freedom from? When Americans say, we fought the British and we acquired our freedoms, they have an obligation to themselves and the rest of us to tell us what those freedoms were and how they have preserved the principle that they say they have preserved in order to keep those free. And then, In addition to that, it seems very problematic. Like, because what I'm saying is, no known, no published, no legitimate American historian has ever countered the premise of the American exceptionalism. It's a consensus among historians. Now, we can find a few historians who have done that, but they're all black sheep historians. Okay, they're all pushed off into the corner. If I may, just for a moment, I have a couple of very favorite American historians I'd like to let you know about. Just my American historians, just to let you know that I'm not really against all historians. Somebody's going to go out here and say he doesn't like historians.